Hi everybody and welcome back to NeuroQol. Today we are going to have a little look at Unit 4 and talk a bit about focus groups. So I am Dr. Charlie Whiffin and with me is
Dr. Sandhini Selvendran.
And we have both conducted focus groups. So we're just going to talk a little bit about what's in the unit and some of our tips, experiences, and hopefully that will just provide some of the context behind some of the content. So tell me a little bit about what you've done with focus group approaches.
Okay, so when I did the focus group, it was, I think we had two big focus groups with different people. So the first focus group was with similar kind of people, so people who worked in the same capacity. In this case, they were care inspectors, or people who worked in the care inspectorate for the care homes. And that was one group we had. So again, how I approached it is that I actually went to the care inspectorate and I had a chat with some of the people so they could again get to know me, understand the project a bit more. But I had already emailed all my paperwork to them prior to that.
We should probably start by talking about what a focus group is. It might not be obvious to some people if you've never been involved in a focus group or come across them in the literature. So maybe we should just start by saying who they are. How would you define a focus group?
To me, a focus group is, as the name suggests, it's a group of individuals. Usually, I suppose for research purposes, we try and make sure it's a reasonable size. So I think literature tends to say things like between 6 and 12, not to be less than that and try not to have too many people. For logistic reasons and for richness of data and discussion. So you need to have a good size. And that's one thing. They're groups. And I suppose when you talk about focus groups, you have them because you want them to generate some kind of, I think, information. I hate using this word, but I have to say it. in relation to your what you want to find out or to your research questions. So that's why they're there. And in terms of the composition of the group, it would really, again, it depends on your research questions. And also it depends on what you think you want to get out of that particular group. So, for example, if you have a group of similar people, let's say all doctors, you can expect to have a certain kind of discussion. Whereas if you maybe had a group with medical students or with nurses and with other healthcare professionals, let's say in the context of neurosurgery, for instance, then it will you'll probably get very different things. So this is what they call the homogeneous versus heterogeneous group focus groups. I think that's the term that's used.
Essentially, what you've got, it's a bit like a semi-structured interview. You're still asking questions and you normally have a schedule which for your focus group, but you're asking those questions to a number of people and you've got a shared area of interest and they normally share something in common, don't they? So you're part of people in the focus group, so they can actually have stuff to talk about. So if they were all completely different and none of them shared the same experiences, no one would say anything. Or they just argue because it all have really, really different perspectives. And I think what's nice about focus groups is, one of the difficult things about qualitative interviewing is the length of time that they all take. And so you always end up with smaller sample sizes, don't you? Whereas with a focus group, if you have a particularly focused area that you're interested in, and you can get a number of people in a room all at once, you can get the views of 10, 12 people within an hour, can't you? Or a couple of hours for the focus group. So tell me a bit about how you, let's go back to how you've used them.
So I conducted two different focus groups for the same research project. The first was with just the group of inspectors and people who did care commissioning work, and we talked about topics which were related to some of the interviews I had done before. So I had done some interviews with people who actually worked on the ground, the people in the care homes, not the nurses, the managers, the caregivers, those people. So things that came up from there were used to generate questions or topics in relation to this first focus group. And similarly, used for another focus group where I included different people who were in the care home and also people who were involved in commissioning. So I sort of mixed them all up together to have a discussion about the topics that the care commission focus group and the interviews, sort of taking your data and using it to generate more. So it wasn't using the same kind of question or topic guide, but basically, I guess it's the nature of qualitative research. You don't have a fixed questionnaire for everybody. It sort of evolves with the data.
You often see that with focus groups, don't you? Quite often I see focus groups in either mixed method or like multiple data collection points. So they might use the focus groups to, generate a questionnaire, or they might use the focus groups to kind of broadly discuss an area of interest and then do follow-up semi-structured interviews to get the depth. So you get the kind of breadth from the focus groups and then tag that into the depth in a semi-structured interview. So you quite often see that, don't you, in kind of, dual method qualitative or mixed method studies. They're quite helpful in that regard, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So it's either with it could be like, well, I think you did that for your study, didn't you? You did the focus groups first and then you did the interviews.
Yeah. So we will do another podcast on the use of online focus groups. But the study that you're talking about, we did an online focus group and then we used follow-up interviews. And the idea, because we went into that study really without a lot of empirical literature, or kind of hardly any empirical literature, just a couple of kind of editorials and discussion pieces and general things that people were saying about research capacity. Actually, we didn't really know what we wanted to look at. So when you go into an interview, if you've only got that hour with that participant, you don't really know what questions to ask them. We were worried that we might not ask them the right questions. So the idea of the focus group was to bring people together in a shared space, generate some discussion around research capacity and what was stopping neurosurgeons from researching and or who or what or why and personal motivations to research and, professional factors that meant neurosurgeons were able to or not research. And that was really useful because it got us to be able to prioritize from a slightly larger sample size what the main issues seemed to be, and we did an analysis of that data, and then from that we then generated a semi-structured interview schedule, so an interview guide, and then we selected a subset of participants to go and talk about those issues in far more depth and detail. And actually that study, if we'd have only relied on the focus group data, it would never have been as rich and as complex as it ended up being. And that's partly because the focus groups were online. Yeah. But I think when you're dealing with focus group data, I think that's one of the, it has potential to be really rich. If you handle it well. And I think, the skills of an interviewer and not the same as the skills of a moderator for a focus group. Yeah. And it's very, I don't know if I often think, reflect on these sorts of skills when I'm in a team. And I think, how do I bring that person into this discussion? How do I stop that person from talking?
Yeah.
And you can see the time ticking on and, you've got some people that are really dominant and some people who are really quiet. And that the thing with a focus group is the focus group create that data together in that space, don't they? So it's not, or it shouldn't be a case of you know, John, what do you think to this? And Sarah, what do you think to this? Samin, what do you think to this? And like a, you know,
almost like one by one, yeah.
One by one. It shouldn't be that, should it? And that's the richness that comes from it of, you know, interweaving with people, interrupting, confirming, disagreeing. That's what makes it so vibrant. And that's why when you bring, let's say, a group of neurosurgeons together to look at discharge advice or professional regulation or, you know, outcome measures, you're trying through the focus group to try and reach some kind of consensus, but also to see the patterns of kind of areas of disagreement, areas of similarity. So the complexity of the analysis becomes really quite advanced, doesn't it?
Yeah, because you're looking at the interaction between the participants. It's not just trying to see what are they saying, oh, they've given me this information or that data or that thing, but it's looking at how they also interact with each other. And the, you know, the discussion and the debate, that's actually the richness of the focus group from my experience. Yeah.
And I know a lot of people choose to record focus groups, don't they? On video record the focus group. And I think you can do one of two things. You can either just audio record a focus group, and either not pay attention to the different characters, if you like, the different participants. Or you can record it and you can try and analyse far more on an individual level between who's saying what and when. And it's, you know, it's, I think we're all a bit more familiar with video recording now, aren't we? Because of the pandemic. Whereas it used to be, you know, you stick a recorder in somebody's, you know, in a room for a discussion, and people are really quite nervous about that recorder. So you have to balance the benefit of that, of capturing the different interactions between participants and the impact that it could possibly have on their willingness to talk.
Because that can make a very big difference. I think in the past people were really quite afraid of anything that was visual, like and record me saying it, but don't record me actually my face, you know. I don't want Yeah, but well, record my voice, that's fine. Yeah.
We're probably a little bit less sensitive to that now, aren't we? And looking at ourselves on Teams. But so did you record, how did you record your focus groups?
Yeah, so we actually got consent to do a video recording of the focus group. So we did that. Yeah.
And did that really help with your analysis in terms of who said what? And
yes, it did, especially for the group where there were different people from different, I suppose, different job descriptions in the heterogeneous group, because you could, and the other thing is, it's really hard to tell from a recording, like, who said what.
Yes, it's always impossible.
I remember, is that Mary's voice or is that... You know, unless you're actually saying, oh, Mary, what do you think? And then Mary says something. But if not, it's really, really hard. Whereas with the video, it's really easy because you know who's saying what. And you also get to capture the expressions of other people. Like if someone says something and somebody goes, you know, you can actually capture that on the video.
No one will see that on a podcast, though.
Right. I was actually... You know, scrunching up my face. Apologies.
That's exactly the point, right?
Yeah. If someone cringes or someone nods their head, you know, you can actually see that, especially if you're doing it by yourself. I mean, if you've got somebody else to sit there and record expressions and body language, that's fine. Or you know, that sort of thing. You know, the person asking the interviewer or the facilitator, and then there's an assistant or a second person to actually be doing the recording of what goes on, and you know, the body language and so on. Yeah, that's different. So the video actually really helps.
Yeah, that's common, isn't it, to take somebody else with you to do a focus group, because they can make some notes, they can watch people's reactions, and especially I think they capture the obvious things that are going on, but again, it's so easy for them to miss the more subtle reactions of different people. So it's difficult, I think, and there isn't a right or wrong answer. I think as long as you understand the impact of your decisions, like if you think your participants won't open up if you put a video camera in the room, then you have to leave it out, because actually you'll be more your data will be more effective by the fact that they're guarded than it will be if you you choose to leave the camera out of the room.
Just let them talk.
It's tricky. But I think I think focus groups they can be really fun, can't they?
Yes.
And participants quite often really like focus groups because they get to meet other people. You know, might be make new networks, or if you're thinking from maybe a patient perspective, if they have a rare diagnosis or they have a condition where they've not been able to speak to anybody else and similar to them, focus group is an amazing way of actually supporting them and allowing them that experience of connecting with other people and sharing their story. And from a professional point of view, if you know that the focus group will have a number of other leading neurosurgeons in it, that's an amazing opportunity to sit and chat with your peers about a collective subject that you're passionate about. I think it's difficult. I think with participants, what's the benefit of participants being in your study? Because quite often with qualitative research, we don't pay them. You know, there might be a voucher or a something, but normally there's no payment. Whereas if you're doing some sort of complex randomized control trial, there's sometimes quite often some sort of, cash
generation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, if you can make the methods engaging and supportive, something that they would look forward to actually participating in, then that's the value of them taking part.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And also some people, I mean, interestingly enough, like some people actually feel more confident in a group setting, especially when they share the same experience and opinion or perception about that thing. Mm. So they feel more inclined to talk, whereas if you caught them by themselves and interviewed them, they probably wouldn't say very much.
So they feel safer in
numbers almost.
But it's true. And I think sometimes we do focus groups because, we want to kind of look at, it's easier for us as researchers to get a collection of people together. But from a participant's point of view, if you're maybe looking at something quite sensitive or, something which is, disclosing their feelings or emotions to somebody else might be unacceptable either culturally or just personally, then actually sometimes putting them in a space with other people, like you say, it just, if they hear somebody else disclose, they feel more able to disclose it themselves. And I remember there was a study that somebody did exactly that, in that they wanted to look at family fathers' experiences of organ removal at autopsy. They thought that in an interview setting that the fathers really wouldn't disclose their true feelings, and especially because the researchers were female, and I think they were really worried that actually that kind of dynamic, the men might take more of an obvious kind of stereotypical male role of, this is all fine, this is okay. I felt like this, but actually we might not uncover the deeper feelings. So they put the fathers in a focus group setting because if one person kind of felt open to disclose, that would then support other people to feel open and disclose how they felt as well. And I thought that was a really nice way of using research methods to support participants. And then they got something, you know, they got a lot out of that by listening to other people's accounts and something that they wouldn't normally have heard those other stories.
Yeah, I think so. So focus groups are great for that as well, not just for getting data again.
Distraction. Yeah. But they can be really hard. Really, really hard. So they're really fun. They can be really vibrant. You can have great conversations, great chat. But they have the worst potential to go off topic.
Yes.
Run over.
Yes.
For people to feel marginalized, for people to dominate. Whilst I really enjoy focus groups, I find them extremely taxing to conduct them properly and get is that what, you know, as a researcher, what you need as well.
Because it's not just one person. Let's say you had six people, that's still five other people then if you just had one interviewee, I don't like to use this word, but I will, manage those other people. You know, you're not just dealing with one person and, you know, talking to them, getting their perspectives, you're actually getting other people's ideas. And again, you know, like exactly what you said, there might be one or two people who just dominate, you know, they keep talking, and every time you ask a question, they're not even putting their hands up, they're just talking and talking and talking, and then going off on their own merry way. Okay.
And the problem is in it, you don't want to stop that person because their story is of equal value to the other people in the room. And you can completely, you know, destroy somebody's confidence by, you know, trying to interject and stop. But equally well, you've got these other five people who you want to bring into the conversation. And that's where, you know, you need to be really sensitive to the participants' contribution and the point in their story, you know, like finding natural gaps to say, could I just bring in Margaret at this point? I can see you nodding away. Does that mean you're in agreement with everything that Tom's saying? And then you can kind of actively gently bring people into the conversation. And that's where your skills are. You're watching, you're not making notes on what people are saying. I think more often in focus groups you're actually watching the body language and the positioning of the other players in the room, and I suppose that's one of the things that really makes focus groups so different to, you know, semi-structured interviews. And I think we talked about the, you know, the parameters of sample size for focus groups being 6 to 12. And that's right. That's what I've seen in literature as well. But managing a focus group of 12 is actually really hard. I probably wouldn't recommend going up as high as 12. And especially now we're moving so many things online and doing, you know, team interviews and Zoom and all the rest of it, that to put 12 people on a screen. Group, that's really, really tricky. So you kind of need to balance, you know, that, you know, sometimes you can do it with 12, probably wouldn't recommend it. What do you think?
I agree. I think there was one, I'm not sure if you were there, there was one NIHR focus group a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And it was on Zoom. And I was part of that. I was one of the participants. And I actually found that incredibly difficult because I don't think there were 12 people, but there were quite a lot of people in there. Certainly not six. It was more than that. And even with that amount, I actually found it hard to say anything or to put my hand up because there were some people who kept talking and kept wanting to talk. And I think as from personality perspective, I'm usually not the one who likes to volunteer to talk. But if I do have something I want to say, I will say it. But in this case, I found that because somebody else was talking and it was online, so I couldn't actually see the moderator or the facilitator at all sometimes on the screen, because the person who was talking was on the main screen. So I just sort of gave up. I was like, I'm just not going to bother to do this. And that's a bit sad, because you lose the perspective of a person who may actually have something very useful to say, something very different or something very rich, as you know, like we like to use that term in qualitative research. Yeah, I find that that's a bit of a shame and unfortunate. I just don't know how to tackle it.
Well, there's more written now about online, you know, focus groups and things like that. But I would, you know, I recommend in circumstances like that, ground rules are really important in focus groups, aren't they? So you quite often have a you know, a few bullet points which are actually, you know, the space is confidential, you know, respecting people's contributions, you know, please don't take that information outside of the focus group, you know, try not to talk over people, give people space and time. And I think actually just thinking about it now, I think if you're data collecting online, actually you should include turning your camera on, because more and more we turn our cameras off, you know, when the calls are large, and then you miss all of that data completely, don't you? And you end up talking to initials in screens. And actually, I would recommend, if you are doing something online, that you do record it. So as long as you can, you know, you put that in your consent form, wouldn't you? And you would consent the person to both an audio and a video capture of the focus group. And it's so easy now to record the visual of a focus group discussion or an interview discussion. So it's worthwhile thinking through whether you want to capture that, so that you can look, you know. And I think I've done several things where I've done focus groups, and as a when I'm in the moment, I experience it one way, and when I listen back and watch the whole thing again, I experience it in a completely different way. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And I think from an analysis point of view, that is actually is really important as to what you're capturing in the moment and what you're capturing post hoc. And we talk quite a lot about reflexivity in research, and I think that's part of unit six, when we start looking at kind of, you know, credibility in quality. But, you know, it's that reflexivity of, you know, what am I thinking? What do I think in the moment? What, you know, what am I, how am I presenting myself? What, you know, what are those initial kind of gut reactions about the data and about what's being, what is in front of you? And you need to capture that somehow. You know, you need to either write it in a reflective diary or do some audio recordings or something, because we shift our perspective, you know, for the different moments in time, the different.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because that was something that I experienced. So I think when I was actually in the focus group and they were all talking and discussing, you know, there's some ideas cross your mind, but then when you look back at the recording and then you think, were those actually right, or was I right to assume those things or think about those things in the first place? Is that really what they're trying to say?
Yeah, you have to work with your kind of assumptions, and whether the assumption is, whether it's data based, as in it's originating from your data, or whether you've jumped to a conclusion which actually isn't founded in the data. It's founded in your lens, if you like, your perspective. And that is so important in analytical processing of qualitative data, because we are human beings, you know, interpreting data, and that is a very human experience, isn't it? But before we start touching on analysis, I think if we just kind of finish, just in terms of focus groups, you know, they are are great for data capture, you know, great for complex discussions, bringing people together. Lots of people, participants get a lot out of focus groups. They're rich, they're dynamic. They are kind of, you know, you're in far less control of a focus group.
Yeah.
And again, recommend piloting focus groups, work, you know, testing things out with colleagues, friends, and having a go at not manipulating, that's the wrong word, but, you know, trying to moderate a focus group and kind of when it gets out of hand. So things like that, I think, are really, really important.
The practical aspects of it, because it can be actually very, very challenging, especially when you're doing it for the first time and you don't know your participants. I mean, you might know them roughly, but you don't know how they are in that kind of setting. So it can be very, very tricky. So you have to be very, you have to actually really set, like you said, the ground rules are super important and they need to be emphasized at the pre-focus group meetings. In fact, I think that's really key. And just before you start the focus group. And I think the principles are the same as well with the interviews. You need to let your participants know what you're doing, what the project is about, and what the research questions are. You know, some people actually send their research questions or their interview or focus group guide over to the participants.
Yeah,
and it's important, and the ground rules as well, because that doesn't always guarantee that they will listen, but at least you know you've done your best in that.
I think but it's about being fully informed.
Yes.
So, you know, if it's not just about the questions you ask in the focus group, it's everything leading up to the focus group and everything after the focus group as well, and treating your participants with respect and making sure that you've had every opportunity to inform them of what's happening and that they've had the opportunity to ask questions. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned is when we've been talking about rapport building, like in the introduction to unit 3, actually we've got a whole nother, you know, group of people who need to build rapport, you know, so actually having that opportunity to, you know, building into your interview schedule that brief introduction of each other, so they know each other and what their background is. And the other thing that I just wanted to say was that there's also, again, that when you bring people together who share an experience, there's quite often a lot which is not said because people assume that they are those other people know.
Right.
That room, there's much that if the collective experience is really strong and similar, there's more of that sense of, you know what I mean, John. So you know what, so all that. So I think, again, asking people to clarify those kind of subjective meanings and metaphors and either colloquialisms or, you know, kind of expressions of it's not said, but it's really important. And they're not saying it because they've already taken it as an assumption that everybody in the room knows about that.
So we're all whatever, you know what I mean.
Exactly. And I think if you bring a group of neurosurgeons together and you're looking at something like complex decision making, if they all share a particular way of doing something, they might not actually explain that because they all, you get it.
Yeah.
We always do it like this. But and you as a researcher, especially if you're not a neurosurgeon, and actually quite often it's quite nice to do analysis on subject areas that you're not familiar with because you don't make assumptions. Mm-hmm. So if they don't tell you something in your focus group, you haven't got that data. You can't, you can't really make sense of it. So good luck with focus group approaches. Definitely something to get involved with. And actually a good way of learning about focus groups is to be a participant in a focus group.
Exactly. Yep.
And to reflect on that experience. So any final words of advice, Sam?
No, I think just go through the unit again. Lots of practical tips and tricks there. Talks about the focus group guide, which is also important, and obviously like how to carry out the focus group, what you need to do before, during, after. Yeah, just read through that. It's really, really informative.
Good. All right. All right, well, we will see you on the next, well, not so, we're looking forward to introducing the next unit. Thanks very much for joining us today.